Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Our guest this hour has written, he's a very young man, but he's written an extremely moving memoir, and he's done many things in his life. Benjamin Bush is our guest. His book is Dust to Dust, a Memoir. And just to give you a brief sampling of what he has done in his life, he did serve two tours of duty in Iraq. He was a U.S. Marine Corps infantry officer. He played in a role as a police officer on The Wire. He's appeared on Homicide, The West Wing, one of my all-time favorite shows, and Generation Kill. He's written for Harper's. He's been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. He's been a guest commentator on All Things Considered. He lives on a farm with his wife and two daughters. His father was a famous novelist, his mother a gardener. And the book looks at a lot of issues. It looks at his growing up. His parents were Vietnam protesters, and he wound up fascinated by war and the Marines and soldiers and guns, and his parents really didn't want him to have a toy gun. He wound up being very much a part of war, and the book looks at war. Mortality is a big theme that runs through this memoir, ruin and rebirth. He says that he has seen cities destroyed in his life, people buried, graves dug up. I have lived outside in the elements. I know that everything is recomposed from pre-existing material, that were all fragments from Earth and life blown apart and gathered up. Pieces of us are from stars and meteors, the ocean, dirt, and the dead. We will not be able to keep these pieces either. Our bodies doomed to be given back to the ground. Benjamin is our guest this hour, and we'll be looking at life and death and mortality and parents and a number of rather substantial issues. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, and I'd be particularly interested in hearing from those of you who have served in war, because I sure haven't, and I know a few people who did, but I think it makes you a different person, and I think that it would be interesting to hear from you on that this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Benjamin. Thanks so much for being with us. Are you there, Benjamin? Hello. Have I got the right line? Hello, Benjamin? Is he on ICN? Oh, he is. Okay, there. I'm sorry. I pressed the wrong button. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you on. So here you've done a memoir, and you're a pretty young guy, aren't you?
Yeah, I think it could be considered that. But, you know, you come to realizations at certain points in your life, and sometimes it's the right time, and I felt that I was at that moment.
Mm-hmm. I love the early descriptions, and actually they're interwoven throughout the book, of you as a youngster. You were, it sounds like you were pretty much on your own, exploring rivers and exploring the forest and exploring all of the elements. You had a great spirit of adventure about you when you were just a kid.
Yeah, you know, I think the book very much traces childhood urges and beliefs through life, and to realize where those impulses lead. The endurance of childhood and the power of memory to preserve place and the place we've come from is really very much what the book takes into consideration. And the idea is that that magical childhood that we all come from in some ways still has messages for us. The people we were, very small, echoes. And I began to hear those echoes looking back.
And also what we learn to value when we're very young, what you've learned to value from your father, what you learned to value from your mother, who figure prominently in this book. I loved it in a sentence you said that you learned to value dirt from your mother. It's great. You learned to value dirt.
She knows that, and the book is Dust to Dust, we rise from earth, we return to earth, and she was very comfortable with earth and was able to make life from it, which was a constant fascination to my father, who was in many ways concerned with nature, that it was somehow stalking him.
And your father was a famous writer, but you didn't take up reading. You obviously have the genetic gift for writing, but you didn't read a lot of books.
No, I was a very, you know, I was obsessed with the tactile. I was very kinetic, and I wanted to engage in the natural world. My literature was landscape, and I entered into that and sometimes fiercely to get as far into the world as I could. I dug and went into rivers, and my father always observed that from a certain distance. He was a great observer, but I had to experience those things. And we kind of both stood on different lines.
And you've already experienced so much in your life, haven't you? I mean, so much drama, so much horror as well.
Well, you know, I don't know how unique my experience is, because I'm just me. All I have is my perspective. But I've always very much engaged in my environment. I've been fascinated by it. And I built the book around these elemental themes because I've always been drawn to water and to rock and to wood. And I really didn't value memory because I was too busy looking forward, as so many of us do,
mm-hmm.
Distracted by what was next and not where I'd come from. And it wasn't really until my return from war and being surrounded by so much confrontation with mortality, and then, of course, the loss of my own parents, that I was forced to look back to find them. And what I had was memory. I realized the power of memory at that time, and thus memoir.
Mm-hmm. I lost my parents, my mom quite a few years ago, my dad about 4 years ago, and I talk to them still every day, every single day. And in memories of conversations we've had and who they were are so much a part of me now. That memory, and I'm sure it's very, very true with you, that you must do the same thing.
I don't know that I talk to them, but especially in writing this book, I had to revisit my youth with as much hope for truth as I could find, because my parents lived in my past now.
Yes.
And I was an orphan.
Yes.
And to find them, I had to go there, and I had to live there. And that's where I had, you know, my vivid remembrances came to me, and I was able to in some ways write them down. But that's their afterlife. You know, we think we've lost someone completely when they die and fall away from us, but in truth, we carry them, and that's what makes the best definition of immortality, I think, I can give us, is that we never entirely disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Even the substance that composes us is not entirely gone, becomes part of a cycle. And that weighed very heavily upon me when I lost them. I feel like many children do when they lose their parents or anyone they love, in that I regret not having focused more on their lives while I had the chance. That's always the regret we carry. But what I realized is that I carry a wealth of their presence always.
Mm-hmm. You sure do. And the gifts that they had as well. So how, the other thing that's really dramatic early on in the book is, here you are, this young child who's exploring the rivers and interested in war and guns and all of that, and you've got these two pacifist parents who were demonstrating against the Vietnam War, who didn't want to buy you a toy gun, and I'm reading it thinking, how in the world did this happen? And then you go off and join the U.S. Marines, and I'm sure your parents must have been scared silly.
Well, the job of the parent is to protect the child.
Right.
That's the perpetual mission of the parent, and the thing they have to do most is keep the child from harm's way. And some children are, you know, destined to seek that. They're destined to step over that line into the world of risk, and the parents are always just out of grasp. It's kind of the nightmare of parents. I have the same thing with my children. You think about a kid about to fall down the stairs,
mm-hmm.
and how you just can't get to them. But they also respected my urges. They knew that I was going to be who I was, despite their best intentions, for me to be something else. They knew they weren't there to craft my identity. They were there to advise and protect for as much as they could, and then I was going to be who I was, and I was a martial creature. I had that in me as well as the artist, and the two were inseparable, and I followed both those lines in my life. And despite the fact that I ended up invading Iraq and then returning there to the city of Ramadi, while my parents protested that war as well, they always supported me. They knew that somewhere I was going to try to find nobility in missions that were even corrupted.
Mm-hmm. And what part of you, you talk about the artistic part and then that other part, you went of all places to Vassar College, and I'll bet that you were a rarity in your Marine Corps unit having gone to Vassar. Were you not?
There's a piece in the book where I kind of describe the Vassarian arriving at Officer Candidate School, and you know, I forever wore the badge Women's College after that as my my nickname there, which I corrected from girls' school. That was my my moment of pride in school, that the women at Vassar had taught me it's not a girls' school, it's a women's college. And I was the only Marine since 1861 at that time.
Oh my!
So there was a stunned silence in the art community, and at the same time, those who knew me weren't surprised, and even those who knew me as a child were incapable of being surprised by the fact that that was also where I ended up. They were not surprised that I ended up at Vassar making prints and drawing with charcoal, but they were also, you know, it was hard to surprise them that I also ended up being a military service member.
And let's talk a little bit more about your decision to become a military service member, because you did this for a long period of time. Not only were you involved in the invasion of Iraq, but you also did learned how to work with joint exercises with South Korea, because there was some thought about there would be another war with North Korea. You spent a lot of your life involved in the military, didn't you? It's all
encompassing. In and out for 16 years, I spent a lot of time in the reserves, and yeah, I couldn't leave. I wasn't able to justify in some way in my soul leaving until I met my daughter when she was one, and she didn't know me, and that was the last pin I left at 16 years, and. But I took it all very seriously as I take art. I took war, and I do believe that there is a just application of force occasionally. You know, there's certain people you just simply can't negotiate with who are a danger to the earth, and you know, I think many people would agree that Hitler probably wasn't going to be placated with language. He was going to take force of arms, and you hope for nobility in your mission. But the Marine Corps doesn't make its wars. It's sent to the ones that its voters do. The electorate, we have to assume, is making decisions for the application of force. And within that, you make a tiny piece of America with the Marines that you serve with. And you try to keep them just and ethical and whatever they're immersed in. You maintain their sense of humanity. That is the true mission.
Did you, as a soldier, have to answer for yourself, just as a human being, whether or not there was a just application of force in Iraq?
I think, you know, when you serve there you are. It doesn't become so much a question about why you're there. That part has already been decided for you. How you serve is the important thing. I mean, you can go into an unjust war and be unjust and give into to those impulses that are fed by frustration or fear or anger. Retribution. All these things are part of war that you have to be careful of. they are the true enemies in some ways because they are within you. The enemies is another thing entirely. And, you know, when I invaded, we had little information in terms of why we were going. I went to find weapons of mass destruction. That's what I was told I was looking for, and to keep them from someone who was predisposed to award those type of weapons to our true enemies, being Al-Qaeda. And we didn't find weapons of mass destruction. And we found a man in a hole writing letters to his lieutenants, telling them not to cooperate with terrorists because, of course, he feared they would subvert his power. So if that's why we went into Iraq, then it's hard to justify that war, isn't it? Afghanistan was a different thing. They actually were based in Afghanistan, and I believed in going there and destroying them where they lived. However, I didn't think that America was equipped, in either case, to transform an entire foreign culture into something that we could in some ways manage. Mm-hmm. Iraq and Afghanistan are going to be what they are and what they should be. They are sovereign peoples who should decide for themselves what they want to be. We can offer them an example, which I think we've tried poorly to do. But, you know, it's not our place to tell people who they are. And that was the difficulty. We were in a place trying to apply a template to something which simply wasn't prepared to receive it.
You were involved in the early invasion of Iraq, weren't you? You were there at the beginning.
Yes, we were a little bit late due to transportation, but yeah, we moved through after Nasiriyah had already been a large battle, fierce battleground, and were left essentially after Al-Qut to the Iranian border, which no one considered to be significant at that time, but I was looking at all the evidence of Iran's border being perhaps the most significant place we would have to deal with if we were really thinking about anything long term, which we weren't. You know, when I was there in 2003, everyone was thinking about retrograde because the conventional army of Saddam had been quickly beaten. And everyone was talking against the idea of nation building, which we went on to do for almost 9 years. So it was a very different time. And my instinct was to paint a portrait of the place in which I found myself, because that's what the artist does. And, of course, it's also very useful to the military leader. And so I listened more than I spoke and tried to learn that which I did not know. And what I found, of course, very quickly is that I didn't know anything.
Hmm. And you got very sick early on.
Well, we called it Saddam's revenge, mm-hmm. but it was a virus, and you usually had it for 2 or 3 days, and it came at a bad time. I was required to be at these village meetings because, in some ways, they thought my authority justified their own authority, and I was trying my best not to steward them. I was trying not to lead anyone except my Marines, and to allow native solutions to arrive from native problems, and to encourage that, and to provide only security, to allow them to decide for themselves what they wanted to be. And one thing they really wanted more than anything was to close off a pipe, which Sajida, Saddam's first wife, who had borne him his two vicious sons, Uday and Qusay, into an aqueduct which carried water to all the villages up to the Iranian border from the Tigris. And water, of course, in a desert is a serious thing. I had read Lawrence of Arabia, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. I had a few things to guess about water and the territorialism of that and the idea of a tribe's commitment to ownership of water. And now that Saddam's government was at it, had been essentially decapitated in terms of its command of the region, they felt that with us, they might be able to correct this great injustice. And it was the first thing I was going to really be able to sit in on, that felt right. That, you know, the one good thing I felt that we may accomplish was to to reverse an injustice which had been done to these people, and that it was their decision to do so. And that was the vote. The vote was unanimous. They argued while I was declining in illness. But during that, a child delivered a note, mm-hmm. which was for my assassination by the Saddam Fahedin. And you do some acting in the military as well. And while being desperately sick and presiding over this meeting where people were agreeing to agree over something which had taken place during the time before our arrival, I also had to defy ideas about my mortality, which I had done since I was a child. And to some extent, I had to believe it. That first tour, I really did, in some ways, carry myself as if I was invulnerable. Some ways because my troops required that of me. But you begin to believe your own myth after you do it for long enough. Mm-hmm. It was my second tour where we were under threat constantly, and I had been wounded within the first 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and I was losing friends there, that I began to believe the opposite, that in fact I would be killed, and that was unavoidable, that was inevitable. So it was strange that those two things, being doomed or being invulnerable, produced the same lack of anxiety. The inability to affect your own fate was comforting, and I think a lot of service members kind of adopt that that strange relationship with mortality, that it changes your disposition towards fear.
Very interesting. Very. Benjamin Bush is our guest this hour. His memoir, and a remarkable one it is, about his time as a Marine, his childhood, his parents, his work as an artist as well. Dust to Dust, a memoir by Benjamin Bush. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Benjamin Bush, our guest this hour, his book is Dust to Dust, a memoir. It has just been published. He is an actor, a photographer, a film director, and a U.S. Marine Corps infantry officer who served two combat tours in Iraq. He has been in The Wire, the HBO series, has appeared on Homicide, The West Wing, and Generation Kill. He's written for Harper's, and he has been a guest commentator on All Things Considered. He has two children now, lives on a farm in Michigan with his wife. Let's go to phone calls. Mike in Appleton, our first caller for you. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Really very interesting, a combination of a warrior and artist. And so I understand what you say about, in Iraq, you don't think about it. You're there, so you do what you have to do. But based on that perspective of having gone through that, plus in your childhood having seen your parents protest against the Vietnam War, I would ask you, what we're facing now, this situation with Iran, would we be justified in doing something there in where, the possibility of weapons of mass destruction probably being very real?
Well, I don't profess to be an international affairs specialist and certainly not one who focused much on Iran, despite the fact that I was on the Iranian border for about 5 months, and that's as close as I got to Iran. What I knew at that time was that we could have made Iran do anything we wanted at that moment. It's 2003. We had invaded and crushed Saddam's army to their west. We were in Afghanistan running amok on the countryside at that time, to their east, and it was in some ways a pretty vulgar display of power, and they were terrified of us. I was able to control the Iranian border by just passing rumors across the border through sheep herds that if we had found a terrorist crossing that border. My mission was to find a way into Iran from Iraq, and that actually was a simple oral rumor that I floated. That I didn't have any justification for, except that I knew the Iranian intelligence officers on the other side were going to respond to that, and they did. They blocked off the entire border for us along about 150 miles, simply because of something they heard a shepherd say. Things have changed. Obviously, we became bogged down in both of those wars. We went into them with very questionable ideas, and certainly no post-hostilities plan in either event. And because of that, we were shown to be vulnerable, and then we were shown to be weak and stretched too thin. And the Iranians got very bold. And a lot of what they're doing and have been doing for the past 5 years has been acting because they know that we don't have the ability to respond. We don't have the manpower to do so. And they even snagged one of our UAVs, showing that they've got technical finesse at this point. I don't know what they really threaten us with. And I don't think they entered into the world stage to be an enemy of the states. We, in some ways, have neglected our relationship with Iran, in my opinion. And because of that, have kind of cut off a discussion with them. And it's made them bold. The same thing has happened with North Korea. I've always considered North Korea to be far more of a threat. And we've been waiting for something to happen for years. Their strange actions now, after we seem to have had an agreement about nuclear weapons with them, is disconcerting. But I don't... You know, on the world stage, it's hard to define the position of one nation. If we can't establish some kind of cooperation through other nations so that we are not bearing the burden of policing the earth for people who might be erratic and dangerous, I think we put ourselves endlessly in an isolated position, and we can no longer sustain that. You know, look what it's done to our economy, 10 years of war. So it's a great question. I'm not the right guy to answer it, but I think that the bigger question is how do we deal with everyone to solve the problems of a few?
I thought it was a wonderful answer. I want to talk about your parents a little bit, what you said about the job of parents being to, if at all possible, keep their children from harm, protect their children from harm. Here you are in Iraq or in the Marines in dangerous places, but particularly in Iraq, where, as you just said, you realized your own that you were not invincible. Your parents, how do parents take in the fact that their child could die? Do you just sort of put it out of mind? And how did you, in terms of letter writing, deal with your parents' very real concern about that when you were dealing with it yourself as your own possible death?
Well, you know, I think when parents write to their children, they write reassurances. They talk about things which are common and normal, and I think it's the best kind of letter you can write to a service member overseas. They don't want to hear about your worry. They want to hear about, you know, what the dog is doing. They want to hear about the flowers in the yard. They want to be returned home in those letters. And I think that's what my parents did, was they painted my house for me in their letters. And that's very settling. It gives you your rudder back in some ways, that there is a place in the world which is not the place you're in, and that it's just as it always was. Mm-hmm. Because we always hope that home is preserved. That's the dream the child has. And the belief, I think, this memoir very much discusses, these childhood beliefs are fierce. And one of them is that your parents will not die. And later, the biggest fear you have is that your child will die. For parents, it's a very different relationship. One of them fearing always mortality's arrival for their offspring, and on the opposite side, the child disbelieving the possibility of their parents' death. Which even at my age, you know, in my late 30s when my parents passed, something inside me, the child inside me, disbelieved that they had died. With all the evidence in the world before me, there was something irrational, which we would call it irrational now, because, of course, we know that death happens. But there was something emotional, which was very powerful in me, which said, no, this is not happening. This occurrence is impossible. And I found that to be amazing, that that there was something from so far in my youth, which was a truth I had come to believe as a child, which had such a powerful echo in my later life. And how parents deal with that is that they worry, and there's nothing you can do about that. There's nothing they can do. I don't think they could manage it either. My father wrote a piece in Harper's talking about that, of how, you know, he would go every day hoping that there was news from me, not from the world, but news from me that would say that I was still in the world, I was still alive. And they would wait between those moments of information. And I think parents do that all over the world. They're waiting for news that their child is okay. And the worst part of it for parents is that they are completely absent from the process of protection. Mm-hmm. You know, that one job they have is to protect the child, and they're not in Iraq with you. They're not walking in front of you, hoping that they'll be hit instead of you, which is what parents would do, you know?
Right, exactly what they would do, yeah.
So that is something that I can only bear regret for, and in some ways it's a selfish thing we do in the military, because we serve with our families. We always talk about how, you know, we use words like heroic, which I'm never comfortable with in the application of discussions about our service members, but we forget very much that the service member is the one who leaves in this urge that they had, which we call selfless, but is also in some ways selfish because of what it does to families who cannot serve, who are left behind. And they're left behind with so little information that I think that almost makes it worse.
Let's go to Ken in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Your guest is wonderful to listen to. I simply have a comment rather than a question. Our son is currently serving a tour in Afghanistan. He's a major with the 4th Infantry Division there. And, Ben, your comments are really soothing to my wife and I. Of course, we worry about him, and we're concerned about him, but listening to your voice for the last half hour has been a wonderful reflection for us. You've said a number of things, which I'm hoping are in your book. I'm online currently ordering it. And I think what resonated with us, for the moment anyway, your comment earlier, a just application of force, some people will not be placated by words. I don't know if what we're doing in Afghanistan is just. I think your comments led us to think it is, and it gives us comfort to know that perhaps there is a reason for our son to be there. We've missed him for the last year, and look forward to him coming home in another month. But overall, I just wanted to thank you for what you're saying on air. You have probably written a delightful memoir, which I will order here shortly, and hopefully enjoy as much as I'm enjoying listening to you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
Thank you. I hope it takes you into your own stories. I think that's the purpose in many ways of my memoir, is that that I am the messenger, but the reader is the star of my book. And if I've done it right, then the way I've painted my childhood and kind of traced it through my life is a journey we all take. And that's the important thing. It's a transference in some way of the importance of this journey that many of us... it's not that we ignore it, it's that we just take it for granted. And I thank you for loving your son so much and so powerfully. And I can tell you that sustains him, and that he is perdurable. And the unknowable things in war are unknowable, but you and he will never doubt that.
Thank you so much, Ken, for the call. I wish we were all sitting together for that one. I'd like for you to meet Ken, and he would love to have a coffee with you, I think, Benjamin, don't you? I think so. What about football? Let's talk a little bit about football here, because here's another thing that must have surprised your parents, that you became a football player. And not only that, but you were really badly injured as a football player. Why? What attracted you to that sport, Benjamin?
I wanted to be a knight.
And, oh, of course.
You know, it was a pretty easy sale that, you know, you put on armor and charge the line. That seemed to be the best pitch you could possibly have for me getting into something. And I mean, it's what led me to the Marines. You know, I think you see that in the book. It's very, very subtle the way I set it all up, but because it's not chronological that way. It's not this led to this, no. Led to this, led to this,
no.
But but all those messages are in there about how I came to do the things I did and why they're not surprising despite being surprising to some people. My injury was stunning to me. I kind of had this idea, as many kids do, that I could risk boldly because I would survive, because I would in some way outwit injury, that I would somehow defy nature because that was my mission. And it drew me into many compromising situations, as you'll see in the book, of course, but in life, you know, I've done far more. And football seemed to be this one sport where you were allowed to exhibit prowess in that way, that it was all a direct confrontation with other people who were equally committed. And it was in some ways, you know, we compare it to war all the time on a very frail comparison, but in some ways it was a direct relationship in my mind at that time. It was the idea of the warrior would dress and fight. What football, of course, presents to you is absolute clarity in who you're fighting. There are no questions about which side you're on, and there's no negotiation. There's no other way to resolve your differences except to just fight it out. I entered into that because that's what attracted me in some ways. War, of course, presents the absolute opposite. In Iraq, even worse. We rarely knew who we were fighting, why we were fighting them, why exactly they were fighting us. And we were fighting in a civilian battlefield, which is the worst place to be placed for something which you want to be absolute. You know, there's children running through your battlefield. What do you do? And our hand was stayed many times, much to our own, position of vulnerability, because we were intent upon doing no harm if it was at all possible. And that was the frustration, was that we were very much alone in Iraq. I think they feel that in Afghanistan as well, is that we're not sure whose war we're fighting. But it's not really ours. And all that clarity that the simplicity of childhood presents to you, which is war, was destroyed. You know, when I went to England with my parents, my father took a study group because he was teaching writing, and he was a Dickens scholar. So, of course, you had to go to London, and I was overjoyed to go to London because that's where knights were. And I was young, I was, you know, 8 or whatever I was, and we went to the Tower of London. I was surrounded by weapons and armor, and, you know, I think there's a piece in there which speaks most to that, which is that, you know, warfare had left nothing behind it but alluring artifacts and mystique. And it seemed like it was a very clear thing that this was, you know, this was a noble effort you could enter into. And I asked the beefeater there, who was dressed in his red uniform and black lace, and I said, you know, I am prepared. I tried to speak as I thought an Englishman would. I should like to be a squire, if it possible. And he could tell immediately that I was not British. because I had the wrong accent. He said, so you're American then? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but you can only be a knight if you're a citizen of the realm, the service of the queen. I'm sorry, you can never be a knight. And I was crushed, just absolutely devastated. And, you know, I had a long discussion with my father about how I could become British. And it, of course, required my father to come up with a story. He's a fiction writer, so I probably believed whatever he told me for many years, as children do. But that was a progression. You know, the armor in the Tower of London led to the armor in football, which led still somehow, despite my realization that this was not a glorious endeavor, really, led to armor in Iraq. Mm. There was somehow a thread that I was always pulling, and that's where it took me.
And how about your daughters? Are they exhibiting any signs of wanting to be warriors?
Well, my three-year-old is definitely a warrior princess. We call her Kira the Fierce because she just has it in her face that she's not to be trifled with. But she's a lovely creature, and I just love her to bits. And my older daughter, who I met returning from war, Alexandra, you know, I have to come up with answers to the existence of fairies, which puts me in a real position, you know. I have not personally seen them, but that doesn't mean they're not there.
Oh, I hope you find some. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. Our guest this hour is the author of Dust to Dust, a memoir. Benjamin Bush is our guest. Benjamin, what can we say about Benjamin? The book is his growing up and his relationship with his phenomenally interesting and worth knowing about parents. It's about his about war, about his strong desire to be a warrior and a knight. As he has said, he was serving two tours of combat in Iraq with a U.S. Marine Corps infantry officer. He's also an actor. He's an artist. He's done political cartoons, and the book is his memoir, which isn't chronological. I was born, and I did this, and I did that. The chapters are all have different titles: arms, water, metal, soil, bone, wood, stone, blood, and ash. More phone calls in a moment, or you can send an email if you'd like. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Benjamin Bush, our guest this hour. Dust to Dust, a memoir, is his book. And we go to John in Pewaukee. Hi, John.
Good morning. Good morning. Wow, it's good to talk to you.
Good morning.
I have to tell you, I'm a first-time caller, and I'm calling in because I was so thoroughly moved listening to this wonderful conversation. I mean, it's really been a joy. And I really didn't have any questions for Mr. Bush, but I did want to, I mean, I had to call in and thank you for this. Oh, wow. What informative and sensitive and enlightening, gentle and humorous conversation. And really wanted to thank you. It's been really, I can't wait to read your book.
And well, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Benjamin, or thank you, John, and thank you, Benjamin, as well, for writing the book. Thank you. I'm interested in the whole process because I find it remarkable that your father was a very well-known writer. You were surrounded with books. You say that you have never been really very much of a reader, and yet you use the language exquisitely, and I'm wondering, where in the world did that come from?
I wish I knew. I think, you know, I think that we all have a voice. How we exercise it requires exercise. And I hadn't read much to my parents' great disappointment. My mother was a librarian. My father was a writer. So you can imagine how they must have regarded this creature that kept on leaving the house and digging holes.
Right.
So stacking rocks and bringing home pieces of wood as if they were artifacts, you know, from the forest. And I didn't write much. I certainly didn't read much throughout my entire youth and into college. And in the Marine Corps, I found myself, of course, in Iraq, and what I had to express myself was language. I knew that no one knew what was happening at home. And in some ways, to reassure my parents and also to kind of paint a picture for myself of where I was and what was happening, I began to write letters. Once a month, I'd write home to family and friends, a single letter. And I discovered in those letters that my voice emerged, that growing up in a house of words, I'd always respected language because, you know, I would have been thrown out if I hadn't. But, you know, I was surrounded by these works of language that were and had in them these huge ideas. Everything's been explored in some way or another, but I hadn't explored it that way. I was a visual artist. I'm a filmmaker, I'm a photographer, I draw, and I'm a sculptor. So I thought that I could explain all my expression by way of in some, you know, physical objects and visual expressions. And I didn't have that in Iraq. My hand was forced. I had to use words. And I knew that choosing words was a dangerous profession. It was something very carefully entered into because you could be misinterpreted. You know, how can you be articulate? And so those letters became my real experience with using language to transfer experience. And I discovered in doing so, people reading those letters began to say that, you know, I understand in some ways where you are. I can picture it in some ways. And that was a revelation to me, that language could do that. Mm-hmm. Because I'd always imagined that my experiences were solitary because no one else was with me when I was young. And in Iraq, you know, my experiences were shared by my Marines in some ways, but not my perspective. And so I was once again really alone again, seeing my world as a visual artist in war. And I was wrong. There was a way to communicate, and it was by communication. And I think that the book, in some ways, began by my realization that I could tell those stories to other people who could live in them like I have in some way. I mean, everyone comes from their own background. They're gonna visualize what I'm writing about in their own way based on what they know. Mm-hmm. But there's something amazing about that. And that's when I think the book began to emerge. I didn't intend on writing a book ever, but it was the loss of my parents and the loss of their stories and the loss of their words that made me want to preserve them, mm-hmm. want to preserve childhood, mm-hmm. you know, to preserve these things I thought were destroyed. And language has done that. This book exists.
It does. It really, there it is. It really does. And people love it. Thanks, John, for your call. Mary in Wood County. Hi.
Hi. Funny thing is, I was just going to make a comment about the letters. My son was in Iraq twice, and I've saved all his letters. However, right now he's really bitter about the whole thing. So I'm not going to give them back to him because I'm afraid he might burn them. Mm. But maybe 10, 15, 20 years from now, I will. And I'm sure
copies.
There's other mothers out there who have letters that, you know, tuck them away and save them.
There are messages in those letters. There is an attempt to find himself, probably in that language, and to explain himself to you in that language. I don't know what he's written, of course, but there's something going on in that. And I have all my parents' letters to me while I was in Iraq. I kept everything, all the correspondence I've ever received. I've actually kept, and that's important. That's important. One-sided discussion each time. He's trying to tell you something in those letters, which is necessary. And I think a lot of people are going to be bitter about war, especially in questionable ones. You know, there's great wonder about whether this entire invasion of Iraq was ever justified, and certainly whether it was worth the blood we lost in staying afterwards, and look at what we've gone through in Vietnam, which we seem to have learned fairly little from. A lot of bitterness about that war as well. So, and I think that's a natural progression of the soldier's realization.
It's good to save them and give them 2 and 10 years. Benjamin, we're out of time. I thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. And I am convinced there will be another book.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I think there will be. Thanks, Benjamin.
Thank you.
Benjamin Bush. The book is Dust to Dust, a memoir. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. And thanks to Brett Jaspers, our new producer for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. The start of the Civil War. We mark that tomorrow. That will be one of our hours.